On Thursday, June 8th, a group of leaders from the local arts and nonprofit communities converged on the Bennington Museum to take part in a second community conversation, a follow-up to one held this past February at the Manchester Community Library. The idea was to bring members of the various community organizations together to trade ideas and learn more about what each one was doing or thinking about, said the museum's executive director, Martin Mahoney.
You have a bunch of people from the not-for-profit community in our area come together and interact, and that's wonderful, but it might be groups that, you know, work with homelessness. They might work for housing, or they might work for the arts, and there's usually not a lot of interaction in our small little bubble, so we can show the intersectionality of all of our efforts and our missions and how we can support one another.
The keynote speech launching the community conversation was given by Susan Evans McClure, the executive director of the Vermont Arts Council. She talked about the work of the Arts Council, what it did, the importance of the creative economy to the overall state economy, and its recovery from the COVID pandemic.
So who is the Vermont Arts Council? We are Vermont's designated state arts agency, and we're also an independent nonprofit. In fact, of all of the state arts agencies, every state and a few territories have arts agencies. Of all of them, we're the only state arts agency that is not part of state government. We are a separate nonprofit. We work very closely with the state, though. So since 1965, the council has been the primary funder for the arts in Vermont. We're also the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Arts, which means that federal funds flow to Vermont through us from the National Endowment for the Arts. Our work is really based on the understanding that the arts transform individual lives. They connect people more deeply to each other, they energize the economy, and they sustain the vibrant cultural landscape that makes Vermont a great place to live, work, and visit. So what we do at the Arts Council is we invest in artists and the creative process, in arts integrated learning, in K-12 classrooms, and in early childhood education and lifelong learning. We work and support cultural organizations that engage audiences, and we work directly with creatives across the region in providing opportunities for outstanding creative experiences. So a thriving creative sector is not only important for our well-being as individuals and communities, but it's also core to the sustainable economic development and thriving communities in Vermont.
We caught up with Susan Evans McClure after her speech for some additional comments.
There's so many opportunities for the arts and culture sector to continue to work together and to grow together and to understand our collective impact, right? To understand how all of these pieces of the creative economy work together and we can help increase the economic infrastructure of the whole state. I think there's also incredible opportunities for the arts and culture sector to get involved in kind of things that are considered non-traditional arts things, right? To make sure that the arts and culture have a seat at the table so that we can be bringing creativity to solving some of the biggest challenges that the state is facing. I think some of the challenges that we're facing are similar to many sectors, continued stress, financial stress, continued not really knowing what's going on in the future. You know, COVID is hopefully behind us, but we're still in recovery mode and still trying to figure out what comes next for a lot of these organizations, and how do we weather the next storm? And hopefully it won't be a storm like we had before, but we need to be ready. And the Arts Council will continue to be advocating for state and federal and private funding to support the arts sector, but it is gonna look a lot different than it did during the days of COVID relief funding. So we'll be looking forward to working across the sector to make sure that people are ready for that and are planning for it and are really doing a great job of telling our stories of what makes the arts and culture a vital part of Vermont.
After her speech, the attendees broke up into breakout sessions to discuss various topics. Those topics covered a wide range of issues. One of the groups focused on the role of social media for nonprofits. Ty Paquette of the Bennington County Habitat for Humanity led that breakout conversation.
If you look at your social media and you're wondering your engagement is low, just know that a 1% engagement is fantastic.
So after the last community conversation at the Manchester Library, it was very obvious that the nonprofits in the area could benefit from just talking to each other, using each other's resources when possible, and sharing ideas, what they've struggled with, see if anybody else has similar experiences. Because why go at it alone if you have a support network like this. So after the last one, I went ahead and created a Facebook group called Volunteer in Vermont for all Vermont organizations to post volunteer opportunities, because there really wasn't anything like that. And the guys that were making this event possible saw that and asked me to do a breakout session and a talk on social media. So we were able to chat, about 10 of us that all have social medias as a nonprofit, and bounce ideas off of each other, which was fantastic.
One of the people attending the event was Lorna Matern, the executive director of the United Counseling Service, which offers an array of social service programs to help area residents. Given the mental pressures many have faced during the COVID pandemic, the arts have an important role to play in the reemergence from the pandemic, she said.
Art plays a huge role in helping people to express themselves. We use it with children who may draw their anger or draw their what their anxiety looks like when they can't use their words to describe it. People who have substance use disorder often use it to express also their story, their trauma and their history and how substance use has affected them. We've used art in many ways, whether it's drawing or writing out a story, as a way to be able to express feelings and history and all of those things that sometimes people have a really hard time expressing.
The Bennington Museum and Manchester Community Library are hoping to make these conversations a regular event, perhaps one every 3 months or so. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The Big Yellow Barn on Route 313 West, just the other side of the Battenkill, is hard to miss. It's mainly used for storing equipment for the town of Arlington, but right behind it is a community garden where vegetables have been and are being grown, some of which winds up at the Arlington Food Pantry and for the summer lunch program at local schools. That's where we met up with Heather Hamilton, the chair of the Bennington County chapter of the University of Vermont Master Gardener Extension Program. Summer's here, and the time is right for planting your vegetables. We asked Heather to walk us through the steps of how to plant a successful garden, and here it is. Well, Heather, just to kind of get us started here, can you tell us a little bit about the Yellow Barn in general before we get going on to the planting vegetables? What's the purpose of the Yellow Barn?
Well, so the Yellow Barn, actually the property belongs to the town of Arlington, and it's also part of the Vermont Land Trust. So it's basically conserved property that can be used for agricultural purposes. So there have been efforts in the past to start a community garden here, and unfortunately there people just didn't stay with it. But as we all know, COVID got everybody excited about gardening. And as a part of that, a group of us who are a UVM Extension Master Gardeners decided to start a victory garden here as part of a UVM initiative around the state. And it was really to grow vegetables to give to the local communities as needed. So in 2020, we started this initial garden to my right, which is the victory garden. And all the produce that we grow here, we donate to the local food bank, the summer lunch program, and we also have a food stand over at the East Arlington Federated Church, where, as we all know, vegetables don't decide when a vegetable wants to be picked. So the food market and the school lunch program are a specific day of the week. So it's really nice to have another place where we can donate food. So that's been going on since 2020, and it's all volunteer run. Everybody who gives their time, we grow the vegetables, we take care of them, we harvest them, etc. In the last 2 years, we also added a cooperative garden, which basically is a group of seven families, and we are looking at all times for potentially a few more families who grow their own food here. They work as a cooperative, which means you don't have a plot that's yours. Everybody works together. So they grow the tomatoes, they grow the broccoli, the lettuce, the spinach, summer squash, whatever, and they share the produce. And as you can see, it's a pretty good sized garden. So we often have extra, and all of that also gets donated. So the goal is that we don't grow anything that gets wasted. So that's really what's going on now. And we've also, in the process of adding a pollinator garden, as I think many people know, pollinators are at great risk in the entire world. We've lost huge amounts, 30% of the bird population in the last 30 years or so. About a third of our insects pollinators since 2008. I mean, it's very scary. And one of the things that we can all do to counter that is to put in gardens that have native plants that support our native insects and birds. And so we're in the process of building one of those also.
Okay, well, let's do the deep dive, as it were.
Deep dive.
Into what are the do's and don'ts of planting a vegetable garden. Looks like we have a couple of instructions here.
We have a few steps. I decided to write them down so we wouldn't skip anything. It's obviously June, so if you're gardening, you've probably decided where you're going to garden, but there are a few things that you should make sure you've taken care of. The first thing is vegetables want sunlight. They need 6 to 8 hours of sunlight. So if you have a garden in the shade, what you're going to be able to grow is basically greens like lettuce and spinach. You're not going to be able to grow a lot of other things. So make sure you've got sun. The second thing is water. Our first year here, our water was about 200 yards away from here. It was a nightmare because we had to run hoses and then we had to pick them up. And you can't put them on a timer. I mean, you have to like be here all the time watering. So you need to have easy access to water, whether that's, a watering can and a spigot or a hose, whatever. You want it to be very close by. And one of the reasons is that I brought this handy little gauge here. Vegetables need 1 inch of water a week. So that's that much water. And you might think recently with all these little scattered storms, like, oh, it's fine, we've had lots of water. Well, if you went out and looked at your rain gauge, you'd be lucky if we had a quarter of an inch, because they're such scattered and such light rains that they're not amounting to anything. So this is a nice thing to have in your garden, just so you can double check and say, yeah, we got a lot of rain this week, or wait, we didn't get anything, I thought we did. So it's really important that you manage that. The other thing is that in the beginning of the year, when you put in your baby plants, you can't give them a lot of water all at once or they'll drown. So you have to water them like every day, probably. It's really hot. We have those really hot days in June. We had to water like twice a day here with our little plants because they just dried out. They don't have enough strength. So it's, you don't want to have to be running around trying to find water, because what will happen is you won't water and they'll die. And we don't want that to happen. What we do recommend, though, as master gardeners, the best thing is if you can put in soaker hoses, that's really what you want to do. We have soaker hoses laid out in this garden. It's a black hose that runs through every single bed. And when you turn the water on, it literally just leaks water all along the garden, down every single bed. And what's wonderful about those, there are two things. A, you turn it on, say for an hour, whatever time you need. You can weed, you can do something else. You're not standing there with a hose trying to do it. But the more important thing is you're not getting water on the leaves. And one of the things that we all learn as vegetable gardeners is that vegetables, especially tomatoes, do not want water on their leaves. Because when you get water on the leaves, you make them susceptible to various fungus that are coming in on the wind. And if the leaves are wet, they'll stick. And if you've ever had tomatoes that just, the leaves are getting yellow spots and brown spots and curling and falling, then you'll realize that something's wrong. Well, it's very likely that is a fungus that has happened because the leaves were wet. And so we really recommend that you try not to get the leaves wet, and also that you put down like a straw, which is what we've done in this garden over here and this one, underneath the tomatoes. So we're obviously outdoors, it's going to rain, they're going to get wet, but you don't want anything splashing up from the soil onto those leaves. So water. And then the last thing that obviously is really important is soil. Soil is usually not perfect in your garden. And so again, we highly recommend that you, especially with a new garden, you test your soil. And that may sound really complicated, it's not. What you do is you go around your garden, you dig a hole in about 5 places, you scoop up some of that soil, put it in a bucket, stir it up, take about a cup of it, put it in a plastic bag, and you mail it to UVM. And I'm gonna show you what the form looks like, because it's really not that complicated, even if it looks complicated. Basically, all you're doing is you're filling out your name and address, your email. If you do an email, you're going to get the results faster than if you just give them your mailing address. And then you list out basically the size of your garden and what you're growing. And honestly, for a vegetable garden, you just put down general vegetables. The back of the form lists anything and everything you could ever want to grow, but you're not growing one specific thing. And every soil test is $15. So we recommend that you just say, use the code for General Vegetables. You put the soil in the bag. The form, if you just go, you can just search online UVM soil test, and that'll bring you straight to the form. And you print it off, you put it in an envelope with the soil, you mail it in, and within like 10 to 12 days, they're going to get back to you with a lot of information, but the most important thing will be the basic nutrients. And they'll tell you what to do if you need to amend your soil. They'll give you specific information. And that can be really, really helpful because, you know, a lot of us have very clay soils in Vermont. We don't necessarily have all the nutrients we need. So we really recommend, especially when you're starting, that you do a soil test. All right, so now we've got the location, we've got sun, we've got water, the soil's gonna grow our plants. So the next question is the size of your garden. Our recommendation in the first year you do a vegetable garden, do not make it too big. It's a lot of work to take care of a vegetable garden, just in the sense that you're gonna be watering it and weeding it and caring for it. And you don't want to get overwhelmed, because if you get overwhelmed the first year, then you'll run away. And it's gardening is so wonderful and so enjoyable that you want to enjoy it. So be very clear in your brain about how much time you have, you know, what size you can think you can manage. The second thing is what type of garden. Now in front of us, both of these gardens are, they're basically flat gardens. They're not, there's nothing in a box, there's nothing in a pot, they're just in the ground. That is the by far the easiest way to start a garden. What we do recommend though, as you can see, we have rows in this garden that are soil, and we have rows that are wood chips. So what we've created basically are slightly raised rows. So the rows that the plants are in are a little higher. It helps them retain the water a little better. It makes it easier for weeding. And in between, we did what's a form of weed control. We're putting down cardboard. You can also use newspaper, a nice thick layer, and then wood chips. And that keeps all the weeds out of your walkways. So you don't have to think about that part of your garden. So think about it. You're taking like a third of your garden and you don't have to weed it anymore because you've got it totally covered. And you need those walkways to get to your plants. And part of the raised row also is it reminds you don't walk in that space. Because when you walk on a garden and you compact the soil, you make it much less vegetable growing friendly. It wants the soil to be loose. It doesn't want you stamping all over its roots. So the raised row is another way to say, okay, that's where the veggies go. I walk on the path, the veggies go in the raised row. You can also do a raised bed. And a raised bed is basically you're building a box on the ground. We have one in a garden over here, which is not really being planted right now. And you can make those as tall as you want. So there's one extremely good reason to do a raised bed, and that's if you don't have good soil and you can't amend it to be good. Like say there was some kind of a plant there at some point that had chemicals or some there are heavy metals in your soil or something that, you know, that you're like, I don't want to grow my food in that. What you do with a raised row is you put down a heavy sheet of cardboard on the bottom, you build your box, and you fill it with safe, clean soil, compost, mulch. And you can, over time, you're going to still test that, but you're now totally controlling what's in that box. And you know that the vegetables are growing in something that's safe. So for that reason, it can be really important for some people to put in a raised bed. The other thing is, as you age, which many of us are doing, a raised row can be, a bed can be a lot easier. A raised bed can be, I mean, you can build it up like 2 feet and you can actually put a nice flat, you know, 2x6 on top of it. And you can actually sit on that while you're gardening. So it can be really, really a nice way to make gardening easier to do as we age. The one caveat is don't make it any wider than 4 feet because you want to weed from each side. You can reach in about 2 feet. You know, you may not want it more than 3 feet wide, but you don't, again, you don't want to walk in it. So you want to do all your weeding from the side. So make sure it can be as long as you want, but don't make it too wide. And I'd say the same thing about the raised rows in the garden. These are actually fairly narrow, but you could go up to 3 or 4 feet, but make sure that you can weed from both sides without walking into the soil. All right, the other option, of course, is if you live in an apartment or something, you can grow in containers. You can take nice big pots or, you know, big window boxes. You can grow lettuce, their patio style tomatoes and peppers, you know, things that have been bred to be grown in a smaller container. And that's a fantastic way to grow veggies if you don't have a lot of space. Or again, you don't have the time or the physical ability to be running around in a big garden, it's really nice to, you can still grow vegetables. So, you know, don't think that you need an acre of land in order to grow vegetables. That is totally not necessary. And so we encourage you to grow them in whatever format you like. So the next thing is, what are you going to grow? I would say the most important thing is you grow something you like to eat. You know, I mean, you can go to the, you go to the, you know, your farmer's stand or your local, you know, grower, and there are all these gorgeous veggies and you're like, oh, I'm going to grow, let's do this, this and this. But if you don't like them, then don't do it. It doesn't make any sense. So think about what you got, you as a family, or as a group like to eat, and then select from that. The other thing I would say is don't grow too many varieties in the first summer. And part of that is because every vegetable kind of has its own cycle. I mean, some of them really come into fruit and fruition like late July, early August, some are early, some are later. Some start and they die off and you can plant something else in there, but you don't, it can be a big management project if you've got, you know, 15 kinds of vegetables. So we recommend first year out, you know, do 8. I mean, just don't make yourself too crazy. And as I said, do things you want to grow, want to eat, not something you want to grow. So I've put a list together over here about actually the process of growing. We live in Vermont and we don't have a super long growing season. We have about 3 months from Memorial Day to mid-September. We sometimes get into the middle of October, but that's not guaranteed. So a lot of things we can start from seed. Anything like a green leafy vegetable, you start from seed, and it should be because they're very tiny and you don't want to repot them. Cucumbers, squashes, pumpkins, those start from seed very well. They start really fast. So do peas and beans. Beets and radishes, carrots that are in the ground, you need to start in your garden. They can't start in a pot and be moved. And then obviously things like dill and cilantro and nasturtiums, some of those things, which there's another purpose for those in your garden, which I'll mention in a minute, those can all start from seed. If you're going to grow the things that many of us want to grow, basil, tomatoes, peppers, tomatillos, any of the brassicas, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, whatever, eggplants, buy plants or start them in your house 6 to 8 weeks before they need to go in the ground. And the reason for that is we can't start those in our garden in June. We will have this nice little green plant in September and it will be frozen and you still will not have any tomatoes, or maybe you'll have a few. So those all need to be started first. And if you're going to start your own, the Farmer's Almanac online has a fantastic planting chart. It tells you, based on your zip code, if you're going to start plants inside, you know, because they know when you can put it outside, it tells you when to start the plant inside. So if it needs 6 weeks just before it goes in the ground, they'll tell you, you know, it needs to start, you know, March 15th or whatever. But it's really, really helpful. And they'll also advise on whether or not they think it's something you should transplant. Because I said, some things are really hard to transplant. They're small, they're sort of fragile. All the lettuces, I mean, they're very light and they don't have a big root mass. And you can transplant them, but they're not that happy about it. So I recommend, I mean, there are other sites, but you know, everybody knows the Farmer's Almanac. And it's very helpful. And they also have a whole nice sort of a system for you can lay out your garden online if you want. You can do it on a piece of paper too, but they have a nice little software that you can use to do that same thing. So you're gonna decide what you wanna plant. The other thing is if you're doing onions or potatoes, those are tubers, they go in the ground. You get those again from a local farm store. If you're doing garlic, that needs to go in the fall. So just, that's a separate, it's a whole separate baby. You put it in the fall, you put a nice, you know, straw on top of it. It sleeps through the winter and it's one of the first things that comes up. It's like crocuses, it comes up very early and you'll be harvesting it around July. So that's something to, you know, to plan on in advance. And if you want asparagus, fantastic, but that's a long process. So you need to plant them. You won't have asparagus for a couple of years. They have to mature, but it's all doable. So then quickly, where to plant. And I say that only, that goes back to the sun issue. So what we recommend, even though we're sort of moving this around a little bit this year, but your taller plants should be on the northern side of your garden, your shorter plants on the southern. And that's purely because of shade. if the tall plants are in the front, they're going to cast a shadow on your shorter plants. So, you know, just it's a very logical thing. We don't necessarily think about it all the time, but if you're growing corn or pole beans, tomatoes, anything that's going to go up, you want those towards the back of your garden. And you know, when to plant, I've already gone over that. Then, you know, use the Farmer's Almanac guidelines to tell you when things can go outside. I mean, there's things we can plant fairly early, like peas. I mean, we can plant that before the last frost, but a lot of vegetables will not tolerate frost. So, you know, look at that for anything you are thinking about starting early, or you want to grow from seed, and that'll be very helpful. And so now we've got all these plants, we've decided what we're growing, we've sort of drawn out where they're going to go in the garden. The next thing is make sure, and I brought a book because it's very helpful, and you can Google this online, but it's a really helpful book. It's called Plant Partners, and it came out about a year and a half ago. It's all science-based. So there have been lots of, you know, kind of folklore about, you know, plant tomatoes and basil, and or plant marigolds to, you know, keep bugs off of something. And not that those were inaccurate, but they'd never been actually scientifically researched. This book has researched all kinds of companion planting. So what companions actually support each other in terms of maybe controlling pests, but also what plants can't go together because they'll actually damage each other. So for example, which I had forgotten the other day, onions and beans cannot be planted next to each other because the onions are allelopathic, meaning that they have a toxin, and they will actually stunt the beans and the beans won't grow. So this is a really great reference to, that you can go in, it, the back index lists out all these different vegetables, and you can go and see what they recommend to grow with it, what they recommend to not grow with it. You can obviously also Google everything you're planting online to see is there something that is going to be damaging. But this is a nice reference tool, and you'll learn a lot from this book about that things that just never would have thought about. Which brings me to our little note on, I mentioned the herbs down here. So we are going to grow dill with our cabbage and our kale because it actually helps to control cabbage worms, which can be a huge problem in your garden. We're growing nasturtium with all of our summer squashes because we have a huge problem with squash bugs and squash vine borers in, well, probably everywhere, but certainly in this part of the country. And they can kill your squash before, I mean, they literally will come out one morning and the squash will be like lying there looking totally decimated. And it's because one of these squash vine borers has gotten up in the stem and is literally eaten through the stem and the plant disconnects from the ground. So we have to watch for those bugs anyway, but putting things like nasturtiums around it can really help you with controlling that. And there are other things like calendula, cilantro, that will definitely be beneficial in controlling certain pests in your garden. So again, the book I've referenced is very helpful in determining what you might want to plant with something else. All right, so that, oh, and actually speaking of onions not being good with beans, but they are very good with peppers. So peppers and onions have a symbiotic relationship and they will actually support each other. So it's interesting. The more you garden, the more you learn. That's all I can say. And then you would like to eat these plants, I think. So that means you need to protect them. And honestly, that becomes one of the biggest challenges. So we have many things that would like to eat your vegetables before you do. Some of them are four-footed, some of them are winged. You know, there's a variety. So as you can see here, we have electric fence around this garden. It's just two little lines of wire. We solar power all of our electric fences. All of this equipment you can, you know, look at places like, you know, Tractor Supply or Agway. I mean, your farm supply stores all carry this because they're used on farms everywhere. So we have the electric fence, which is really for, basically it's for the deer, which in Vermont, I mean, let's be honest, they're pretty intense and everywhere. They're in everyone's garden. And they can pretty clear cut a garden pretty fast if you let them in. So the electric fence, which is, it's actually quite inexpensive to do, and you're not gonna have an electric bill because you're using solar. So we do recommend that if you have deer in your yard, which you probably do. The other thing that we recommend is, this is called insect netting, this white sort of foam that you can probably see in the background.
And that does two things. It does help prevent a number of insects from getting on your plants early in the year so they can get established, they can get big and healthy. And it also will keep out things like rabbits, which are a problem for us here at the Victory Garden. We've had rabbits, we've had foxes, we fortunately have not had woodchucks. Woodchuck would go right through this, but it will keep out rabbits, and that really makes a big difference. Because our experience has been that if the plant is small, it's much more likely to be chomped down by one of these creatures. Once they get big and healthy, we have much less of a problem. And reality is, once these plants get bigger, the insect claws needs to come off because they have to get pollinated. So right now we're actually keeping all the bees and pollinators out in an effort to keep out other things like squash bugs and, you know, different aphids and other things that are going to attack the plants, especially when they're young and don't have a lot of strength. So the obviously fencing, mulching is another thing that we do to protect the plants. As we mentioned, it's under the tomato plants right now. That's to prevent any bacteria, fungal disease to splashing up on the leaves. But it is also going to help you keep the weeds down. And weeds are, you know, technically another pest. Weeds are going to take all the nutrient and the soil, the water, away from the plants. And they're going to be fighting your vegetables. So it's putting mulch down makes your life a lot easier. I mean, you could be out here, you can weed all the time, you can leave the soil exposed, but it's a lot more work. The other thing that the mulches do is it actually protects your soil, because wind and rain will actually start to reduce the nutrients in your soil. So if you've protected it with, as I said, we have straw, you can use leaf. We don't recommend wood chips on young plants, only because wood chips actually are going to suck some of the nitrogen out of the soil to help them disintegrate and to start to turn into mulch. And that's, again, that's going to kind of pull from your plants. So if your wood chips have kind of rotted and gotten nice and soft and mushy, that's fine. But fresh wood chips, we would not use as a mulch around young vegetable plants. So if you use basically these techniques, and the other one is just you. We actually check vegetables like cabbages and all the squashes during the season, and to watch for these bugs, because the squash vine borer, the squash bug, the Colorado potato beetle, the three-stripe plant bug, there are a lot of beetles that attack. They don't just attack the cucumbers or the potatoes, they attack your tomatillos. They're hungry. But they're a good size. I mean, you can see them. You know, they're yellow and striped, or they're a good sized bug. And we literally will go down the path with a bucket of soapy water, and we just pull them off and we dump them in the water. And you know, we literally manually remove them. We're not into using chemicals, and so we have to basically, you know, fight fire with fire, which means our fingers do a lot of the work in keeping these gardens protected. And which is another reason, when you start, don't make your garden too big, because it's, you know, you want to check your plants and you don't want to be spending hours doing that. Fortunately, with most of these bugs, they have sort of a moment when they bloom and they're all over everything, and then they kind of calm down and the season gets a little calmer as we go through the summer. But at that point, you may be dealing with different issues like not enough water, a drought, and, you know, trust me, there's always something to do with your garden. And so we finally, though, now we've gotten through all this, right? You've planted, you've protected, and now you have food. And so harvesting is honestly the best part. It's why we do all of this. And as I said, things harvest at different times. Your lettuces, your peas, they're going to be early summer. They don't like a lot of heat. You can plant them again late in August and get a fall crop. But they're not going to be growing for you in July, in the beginning of August. It's just too hot. Your squashes are going to start coming in midsummer, and they're just going to keep coming. Your winter squash, you're probably not even harvesting until you get the first cold snap, because they're still, you know, they're still getting harder and happier. As long as you don't have a problem with squash bugs or squash vine borers, you could have zucchini pretty much, I don't know, starting mid-July all summer. I mean, it really keeps reproducing. It's great. Beans you can grow all summer. The first round will be there'll be a lot of beans, and then the plants will still be there. They'll stop producing you. So you can just take them out and put in another row. I mean, you can put in at least two crops of beans across during the summer, even in Vermont, because they come up very, very quickly. And then all of your brassicas, like broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, they take longer to develop.
You'll get broccoli midsummer, and then it'll be over and finished. It'll start having little florets, which you can eat, but those big heads you will not have after midsummer. We found Brussels sprouts are really a fall vegetable. I mean, by the time they've really filled out and are nice and big, it's like October. And you can actually leave them in the ground through several frosts. It keeps them fresh. They will not go bad on you. And so then when you're ready to eat them, just pull the whole plant out, take the Brussels sprouts off. And that is literally, you can do that at Thanksgiving. You can do that very late. The cabbages and cauliflower, you know, mid to late summer, they'll head up, and then that's it. Obviously, that's a one shot on that plant. You pick it and you've got it. And that's, you know, kind of how it works.
Okay, now it's your turn. Time to plant and watch those veggies grow over the summer. Have fun and good luck. For the Jeanette TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. Holy Smoke Road in Shaftesbury is one of those dirt roads that runs up the side of a hill and circles around near the top of the ridgeline, offering a fairly spectacular view of the valley to the north, which offers a clue as to how it got its name. More recently, the fields and wooded areas south of it, looking towards Bennington, have been the site of a not unfamiliar controversy and tension between two opposing values that also have much in common. Should the land be turned over to a large-scale solar development involving thousands of solar panels to provide much-needed, renewable, non-fossil fuel-generated electrical energy that will help fight climate change and global warming? Or should the fields and forests remain untouched, preserving an area not only scenically beautiful, but also a biologically important ecosystem? Not unlike several other solar developments proposed in Bennington and Manchester, opponents and advocates share similar goals, but disagree over where are the appropriate places to build renewable energy facilities like solar. Freepoint Solar, an energy firm based in Connecticut, has proposed a 20-megawatt solar farm that would be one of the largest in the state. It's been greeted with much opposition from local residents. To hear from both sides, we conducted interviews with Reed Wills and Peter Ford, two of the principals behind the solar proposal, and Kit Auchinett and Jesse McDougall, two nearby residents who live close to the proposed development, to hear their differing points of view. We started with Peter Ford and Reed Wills.
Well, what attracted you to the Shaftesbury site down there, and kind of what makes it a good one from your standpoint?
So I think there were a couple things that drove that. You know, New England, you know, is a good market. We've tried to, you know, break into that New England market for quite some time. We found this site in 2017 and did try and earn contracts with that through a couple of broad solicitations. It takes a long time to go through the authorization to connect to the grid. So part of the reason we hadn't advanced our permitting is we wanted to get fully established with our grid connection. And, you know, that's the other thing. You know, there are probably three things that make it a great site. So the first one is it's good market. Second one is it's on a highway. It's got 3D abutting neighbors, and it has a lot of natural vegetative buffer around it. So we thought it was a nice, you know, pretty quiet place to go when you consider the rolling hills and fields in Vermont. And then the third reason is the infrastructure goes right through the site. So there's, you know, the H towers come across Route 7, come onto our property and then head north. And so we just thought that those three things made this a very unique piece of property, and one that we thought we could execute effectively, not only as a solar project, but, you know, just as a good neighbor, because we weren't going to impact people in a dramatic way.
We've looked at a lot of projects, and this Shaftesbury project, for all the reasons Reed mentioned, it's along the highway, it's under a transmission line, it's shielded generally from the neighbors, not 100% from all of the neighbors, but you don't have view sheds for, you know, large vistas and other things that are very common in New England. So we really liked this site. We obviously understand why there is some local resistance, but frankly, everywhere we go, we get local resistance. So that is not uncommon. And much of the local resistance has a similar theme, which again, I think has merit, which is this is our quiet community and we don't want outsiders here doing some commercial activity. And we understand that. And, you know, that's valid. But I do think we have faith that, yes, there will be some disturbance to those handful of neighbors who are particularly affected during the construction period. But after the construction period, these are very quiet, very peaceful neighbors who just, you know, we're going to shield these projects with vegetation if they're not already shielded with the natural contours. And I don't want to put words into anyone's mouth that they'll love it, but it will not be disturbing to the quiet pace of life that exists today after that, you know, brief construction period. So people get nervous about change. We understand that. We see it in all of the jurisdictions where we work. So it's not uncommon. It's not without merit. But, you know, if we are going to move towards a lower carbon future, there are some trade-offs, and we think these are reasonable trade-offs to make. A
couple things I'd like to add to what Peter was saying in terms of how we interact with the community. So, you know, the first thing that's incumbent on us is we go into a community, and Shaftesbury is very typical. They've seen some small-scale solar. When they see the bigger scale, there's, you know, all kinds of questions they have about erosion. And you know, that's why we ran our open house, which I think was very successful. I think if you look at the record at the PUC of public comments, you'll see a lot less in terms of comments. You still have people that are just generally upset that this type of project is allowed to go forward. And that's a, you know, policy decision and goes to, you know, how people feel about climate change versus, you know, other types of things and clean power generation. But we think it's really important to get the experts out there, get the testimony out there and educate people on noise, on erosion, and all the different steps we take to protect the public. In addition to that, there's a number of benefits that will flow to the residents. There's certainly going to be some increased tax basis, roughly $200,000 a year that gets split between the state and the town. We've met with the town several times. We're talking with them about some projects we could do for them. And I just thought it's important to point out down in, you know, Coxsackie, which is where our New York project that Peter referred to about an hour south, you know, Freepoint funded, you know, special grant program for the school district for their STEM program. We did some funding for the fire department. We did a fairly extensive mitigation program for raptors. And, you know, we're very open to do those types of things here. We're offering to conserve the balance of the property, the forested area, about 70 acres of prime forest area that we're going to put into conservation. We're going to increase the tax base. We're not going to be a user of services. So that's all net income to the community. And we're open to other ways in which to interact and be a good neighbor. So I think we have a good track record with this. We're going to continue to have a good track record with us. I think as people learn more about what a solar project, how it interacts in the community, I think you're going to see more and more people get comfortable with it. And they're going to learn, you know, we're not going to be strangers as the months roll by, and I think people will get more comfortable with us. So that's our approach.
Then we heard from Kit Auschnitt and Jesse McDougall, two Shaftesbury residents who live near the proposed solar development.
What are your main concerns about this? What is it about this project that really keeps you awake at night or whatever?
Oh, God. There's so many things that it's hard, but I'd say the major thing for me, you know, they're all the accessory things, like, will I ever be able to sell my house kind of things. But to me, those are the secondary issues. The main issue is the destruction of the ecosystem that's on that hill. And That's what keeps me up at night. Just thinking that I'll be sitting here in my house listening to chainsaws and backhoes and bulldozers tearing that hill apart and leaving an industrial wasteland, building an industrial wasteland where there was once a thriving ecosystem. And to me, that's as anti-Vermont as one can get. I can't even imagine, you know, moving here. I moved here because of the opportunity to live in nature and be part of nature. And this is about as far from it as you can get, if they can get away with this.
Yes, I agree. There are 1,000 reasons to dislike this project. I don't think leaving environmental regeneration or solving climate change in the hands of billion-dollar energy and gas oil companies is the right move. That land up there is a healthy, functioning, biologically diverse photosynthesizing paradise. It is doing exactly what we need healthy land to do ecologically. I understand Vermont wants to move in the direction of renewable energy, carbon-free energy. I support that. I understand the need for it, but a tool is only as good as how and when it's used. A hammer, I love hammers when they're building my house. I hate hammers when they're breaking my thumb. Solar panels are a tool like any other, and I cannot think of a more destructive implementation of solar energy production than cutting down healthy functioning forest and scraping topsoil off of so many acres of healthy meadow. We are degrading the very thing that we need to get us out of this ecological mess. And it's
disheartening.
It's upsetting that humans are panicking to the point where we are ripping down that which we're trying to save. We are turning to technological solutions for a biological problem. If we think about this globally, 2/3 of the globe's landmass is desert or grasslands turning to desert. They are not photosynthesizing or not photosynthesizing as well as they should. And photosynthesis is the only process that's pulling carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. It is happening in Vermont in these Green Mountains, a state, the Green Mountain State, famous for its photosynthesis, right? It is happening here in abundance. And as stewards and inhabitants of that green and growing ecosystem, which is shrinking every day on the planet, I think our role in the climate fight is to protect and strengthen the ecology, diversity, resilience, the natural cycles of the land that are functioning here and made us famous and a special place to be. I think if we're just thinking in terms of Vermont, our focus is too small. And the idea that we're going to be the energy capital of Connecticut, you know, because that's where the profits are going and that's where the benefit is going to. I think it's a dereliction of duty on the behalf of our elected officials who we would like to protect the citizens of this hill and the human and wildlife and plant communities. We need their protection, and they are inviting in the wolves of Wall Street to tell us what and where we can we can do with our resources.
Yeah, and we're both proponents of solar energy. I want to make that clear. You know, I have it on my roof. Jesse has it on his barn's roof. And that's where it belongs. I mean, that's where solar panels belong, and they belong in other degraded areas. And there are plenty here to use for that purpose. the one thing that drew these guys to this particular location was the power line. And they, you know, so they're taking advantage of that. They're doing the lowest cost implementation they can do. And they care nothing about Vermont, I can guarantee you that. None of them are from Vermont. There are some consultants who come from Vermont, but you know, it's really disturbing that this should be allowed to get this far without any real pushback from the state, the town, the district, wherever. Saying, well, wait a minute, this isn't right. You know, when I first opened this plan in December and looked at it, I said, how can they do this? It's not plausible that anyone would let them get away with it. And yet, here we are, about to enter to a trial at the PUC.
The solar project is currently before the state's Public Utility Commission for a Section 248 Certificate of Public Good, and an initial hearing is planned for later in June. For more background on how this proposed project fits into the regional approach to solar and renewable energy, we spoke with Bill Colvin, the Executive Director of the Bennington County Regional Commission, and Janet Hurley, the BCRC's Assistant Director and Planning Program Manager.
So the Regional Commission, every 8 years, is responsible for generating a regional energy plan, which is in addition to the overall regional plan that it creates. And in one of the aspects of the regional energy plan is to look at existing energy demand, project future energy demand, and then consistent with the targets set by the state for renewable energy in 2030 and 2050, try to ascertain what contributions the region can make towards those goals. And in the case of solar, which is obviously apropos here, we break down in the regional energy plan by community kind of target goals by 2050 for new solar generation, which, you know, as we just looked at the regional plan, the goal by 2050 for our region is about 80 megawatts of new solar production. So, you know, what are the strategies for accomplishing that is outlined in the regional energy plan, and as well as, you know, possible sites where that generation might occur, where the circumstances are such that it would be a site conducive to solar generation or wind or hydro or whatever renewable source you're looking at. So that's one aspect of the regional's work. The other aspect is working directly with the municipalities as they evaluate kind of their needs and concerns and opportunities with regard to energy as well. And several of the regional towns have adopted enhanced energy plans where the towns take a kind of deeper dive in what can the municipal contribution be to that, what should be the strategies for accomplishing increased renewable energy in the community, and on the flip side, what are the concerns? What would they like to see with regard to screening or traffic control or other mitigating efforts? So in the case of Shasbury, when the town did its most recent municipal plan, they decided not to pursue an enhanced energy plan at that time. They were very open to kind of the widespread opportunities to install solar as a result of kind of potentially as a result of this project. But given the attention to this project, Shasbury has recently engaged BCRC to, in fact, assist them with developing this enhanced energy plan, which will actually not be done in time to have any bearing on this particular project.
So, I mean, it's not something of this scale hasn't been done in this part of Vermont, and in fact, it's only the third facility of this scale that's been proposed in Vermont, with one having been built in the last several years in Ludlow, I think, is the place. So, it's a new scale of solar development for Vermont. The Shaftesbury Energy Plan, as it currently sits, certainly didn't anticipate anything of this scale. The Regional Energy Plan, I don't think discusses, scale as, I think the wind energy and scale is something that was more on people's minds than solar and scale. And so I think going forward, this is something that we will address in any future revisions to the energy plan, but it's definitely something that is new to what people have been thinking about in this region.
So where does this now, the permitting process stand now? It's before the Public Utility Commission at some point, I guess later this year, will they make a decision on whether to give the Certificate of Public Good or the Section 248, and that'll be what, a yay or nay? And
For an extended period of time, and back when the project first came to light, there's something known as an advance notice period, which has to be at least 45 days. It was substantially longer than that in this case. And then Freepoint/Shaftesbury Solar formally submitted the application on May 3rd to the Public Utility Commission to kind of officially start the clock for the Section 248 process. There's a scheduling hearing next week on June 15th, which will kind of slate out the possible dates for the hearing and how that will play out. All of the parties will kind of come together and compare calendars, and we'll have a much better idea of kind of timeline after that. You know, I should note, we haven't really talked about BCRC's role in this. As a regional planning commission, BCRC is a statutory party to any Act 250 or Section 248 process and has the ability to provide comment. And really, in this case, we expect that our comments will be limited to how the project is consistent with the goals and policies of both the regional plan and the regional energy plan. So, you know, people have asked us, will BCRC support or not support this project? It's really not our role. Our role is to evaluate the project and its consistency or lack of consistency with the goals and policies of those two regional plans.
The complexities of bringing more renewable energy sources while integrating them into Vermont's landscape remain pronounced and often controversial. Finding the boundary lines between community interests and individual ones is clearly still a work in progress. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. The world, and our neck of it, have at least two big challenges in the here and now. One is climate change, a slow-moving, long-term issue that is sometimes hard to see until a major storm or climate event upends things for a few days or weeks. Another is housing, or rather the shortage of it, and which is within the price range of typical people. What if the solutions, at least in part, lay in tackling both of them at the same time? That's what Marcus Jones, a self-described systems thinker, is tackling with a group of house projects, one of them in Shaftesbury. Regenerative housing is one way to describe it. It involves reclaiming cast-off materials that still have some use and value left in them, and incorporating them into homes that harmonize with the environment to make a minimal impact and footprint. The built environment accounts for about 40% of global carbon emissions, so finding some climate-friendly approaches to home construction and housing would be helpful as ways to reduce carbon emissions intensify to meet state climate goals. And if that can translate into lowering construction costs so more housing units can be built, that's a win-win. We met up with Marcus Jones at a site in Shaftesbury where he's hoping to build a small home that would accomplish both goals.
Once you see the system that we're living in and relying upon, we're the only true consistent input into our system of the planet is the sun. So ultimately that's what nature has learned to operate on, is the year, the sun from the year on an annual basis. And we're right now taking sun's energy that came to the planet and made fossil fuels hundreds of millions of years ago, and we're massively extracting that. And we basically have a limited amount of resources. We don't know how much we have of that stored fossil fuel, stored photosynthesis to rebuild out generation after generation of technological things that have a one generation lifespan. The buildings we're talking about building have, you know, 6, 8 or more generations to provide value. So it just comes out of this passion of once you understand how, like, I don't see another option other than building homes and housing in our built environment in a way that sustains life. Because if we don't figure it out now and do it now, we're going to be figuring it out how to do it later without the stored energy of, right? Like, I'm driving a gas truck. I need to be able to have impact. But, you know, like that, utilizing any of those materials towards it, it's not fossil fuel free, but it is working towards a place where that truck will no longer be needed if this house sustains our lives.
Known as the Shasbury Solar Project, the idea is to demonstrate the benefits of aligning the built environment with the cycles of nature using appropriate technology to efficiently harvest the sun's energy.
Well, the concept design is a hemicycle shape. It's a Frank Lloyd Wright design, which is where you have a concave curve that is centered around the sun. And what it is when the sun comes up in the morning, it comes into these far windows, washes onto the rammed earth wall, so the heat gets absorbed into the wall. And then as the sun pivots through the day, that the sunlight washes throughout and evenly covers all of the interior rammed earth walls that absorb that heat. And so it's that circular shape. This behind us is the kind of like test excavation that we did last year, which is a representation of the various levels of the building. So we could see where we are in relation to the land. We can see how the water flows through the year before we even design or like plan the whole building out. And so the level we're on right now is the base level of an undisturbed soil level. We aren't going to go any lower than that. The next kind of 3 foot step up is a representation of how high the crushed stone would be that sits underneath the building. So thinking the building needs to have a very impressive, well-drained foundation. And one of the best ways to do that is to create a whole bed of drainage underneath it. And then that next slice that you can kind of see is the roughly the first floor level. So you can see when you're on the first floor, behind you, you're surrounded by earth. You're burned into the earth. And there's another slice that we left as natural just so we could see what it is. But there's like 4 kind of pie slices that you can see. They're wider at the back side, and then they're narrower at the front side. The other thing that's been identified is that we don't have a workforce to do this, right? Like, we can't go out and just find people that that have this ability and skills. So we really have to start training the next generation. And we're starting that this summer with an internship. Jorn here is our first intern.
We also got to chat with Jorn Connors, an architectural intern who is working with Jones.
I'm currently in college right now studying architecture. So some of the things I've been working on are some of the design aspects, wherever I can step in. Also basically just, you know, helping him with busy work, you could say. But yeah, taking on projects like these, it takes a lot of hands and a lot of work. So the design build classes always fill up. So doing, you know, a lot of hands-on, on-the-field kind of projects like these, I think would interest a lot of people, especially regenerative building. It's a big part of architecture these days, so it's good to see that coming up here.
We probably won't be seeing multi-unit affordable housing complexes built this way for a long time yet, but at some point, this approach may seem like a solution to two problems, and scale upwards. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.